Now, what I thought, what I do now is open it. We have a little bit of time and have some questions and discussion and comments or whatever you like. Yeah.
I found strain borders from cubbies. So this is a dog who is very hungry and needs attention and needs everything. Although it's really wonderful, loving kind of I'm just thinking that certain activities in our daily life, you might not be sitting on a cushion or something like that, but you can really generate something like the thing in the heart.
I'm saying this for the benefit of the people who someday might listen to the tape. hello. Deshan Singh, that things in our daily life can sometimes be actual fields for practice. And she gave the example of living at Ruth's house. This is one of the Dharma students in Seattle who has these two rambunctious dogs. And that one is, well, they're both in need of loving kindness, but one especially right now. And that's part of our Dharma practice, you know, just learning to relate to this dog that is tearing all over the house that the owner has to give away because it's, you know, it bit the neighbor and it, you know, trampled on another neighbor's cat and so on. And so, yes, this is definitely how, you know, situations where we put the Dharma into practice. So we shouldn't think that Dharma practice is just sitting on the cushion and having our nose in a book. Yeah, I mean, it's really active in terms of how we relate to whatever sentient being is right in front of our nose at a particular time. And when Ruth lets those dogs out, they are literally right in front of your nose. Going, doop, doop. Yeah. And to have loving kindness for them, or whoever it is, when you go into work, a colleague who's in a bad mood, or a colleague who's going through a rough time, you know, to have some kind of kindness to that person and respond to them with cheerfulness. So that's really part of our practice. You know, we often get this bodhicitta mind of, you know, I want to become Buddhist to benefit all infinite sentient beings. I'm going to rescue all the ones in the hell realms, you know. I'm going to rescue all the hungry ghosts and the animals, and we go through the six realms. I'm going to rescue all of them, you know. But I sure can't stand my neighbor who blares their radio when I'm trying to meditate. Oh, that person, this, how did I live next door to this creepy person who just plays their radio so loud? You know? Okay, this is time for Dharma practice. Okay? And, you know, that neighbor is our Dharma practice. That neighbor is the representative of all infinite sentient beings to us at that moment, you know? And having some compassion for that person and having some ability within ourselves to endure the difficulty of listening to their radio. Yeah. That's our Dharma practice. Yeah. And it's so easy sometimes to miss that and to feel just so irritated at the people around us. And if they would only be nicer, I could meditate better and develop more compassion. Yeah. If my family would only be nicer to me, yeah, if my kids would only leave me alone, then I could practice Dharma and then I would be a much nicer person. But, you know, those people are the ones in front of us at that very moment that we try and have compassion with. And your kids may be screaming at one particular moment, but they may not be screaming all the time. And I think you have the opportunity as a parent to teach your kids how to sit quietly. How many times, those of you who are parents, how many times do you think your kids see you sitting quietly and peacefully? Do they have a role model for an adult who can be quiet and peaceful? if they don't have that role model in their home, how are your kids ever going to learn to sit still? You know, you're always going, oh, I wish my kid would sit still and shut up. Yeah. If they don't see you being peaceful and calm, how are they ever going to do it? And so I think sometimes just doing a little meditation can be a very nice family activity. Even if your kids are little and they're drawing or whatever, they can sit and be quiet in the same room with you as you're meditating. Or when you're chanting your mantra, you hold your child and you teach them the mantra and you chant the mantra out loud. Now, and kids get this, you know, incredibly peaceful feeling. And this is Dharma practice, bringing it right into what's happening. Are there comments and questions? Yeah.
I just have a small comment. I just think that it was really wonderful for you to share your faults with us, because really some of the things, especially when you were talking about for me, it really made things in myself so much more obvious. Mm-hmm. So I think it was very wonderful thing to do.
Yeah. Oh, somebody praised me. How nice. I passed the microphone to you, Anne.
And thank you for your fall.
Yeah, she praised me for having my fall. For sharing this. Thank you. Yeah.
I like when we can talk about the faults even more now. That's the word compassion. You can see the Buddha with the big eyes. I have a tendency to, you know, as you mentioned, I like to try too hard to achieve like perfection or enlightenment at such a high speed, short stance. And one of the things that I never noticed is how to be more loving and caring towards myself as within my own imperfection, as you have mentioned earlier. I guess my question is that you gave some how to be more caring and compassionate, and also what other suggestions you have for practices that you can do to recognize it.
Okay. So, other suggestions for developing care and compassion for ourselves. Okay. One thing I think is to really think about, what does it mean to have care and compassion for ourselves? Because you hear that as it's kind of a buzzword nowadays in society. Oh, I have to take care of myself. I have to love myself before I can love others. So I love myself, so I'm going to go out and buy myself some new clothes. I love myself, so I'm going to go out and buy myself the new sports equipment I've always wanted. I love myself, so I'm going to go out and find a new lover, because, you know, in addition to my spouse, you know, whatever it is. People nowadays, it's a buzzword, take care of yourself and love yourself, but they don't know what it means. And they, you know, most people think it means giving myself more objects of attachment. Okay? If I give myself chocolates, cake, and new clothes, and sports equipment, and a lover, and a this and a that, then I'm being kind and compassionate to myself. That's wrong. Okay? Indulging our attachment is not the meaning of being compassionate to ourselves, because we give ourselves our objects of attachment, and we're still dissatisfied, aren't we? And then we have more problems. We give ourselves, oh, I'm going to give myself chocolate cake to be kind to myself. And then you eat chocolate cake. And then, you know, you're big and too fat and unhappy with yourself. You know? Or, oh, I'm going to be kind to myself and, you know, go out with somebody else, leave my family at home. Then all sorts of problems happen when you start cheating on your spouse. You know? So we get very confused about what it means to be kind to ourselves. I'm going to be kind to myself. I'll drink a little bit. I'll smoke a joint. Relax. That's being kind to myself. It's not. You know, our mind gets completely confused. Yesterday I visited a man in Statesville, the prison. He got drunk and killed somebody at age, you know, 19 or 20-something. He's my age now and still in prison for it. May not ever get out, you know. You get intoxicated and do one stupid thing and finish. So, you know, we don't understand what it means to be kind to ourselves, and indulging our attachments is not really being kind, because often we hate ourselves for it afterwards, or we create more problems for ourselves. I'm going to be kind to myself, so I'm going to go buy something. And then you get yourself in credit card debt. And you know, what kind of misery is credit card debt? My goodness. Yeah. So, you know, and from a Buddhist sense, you know what having compassion to ourselves is? It's the first principle aspect of the path, what they often call renunciation, or the determination to be free. That's what is the real meaning of being compassionate towards ourselves. Because isn't wanting ourselves to be free of cyclic existence the most compassionate wish we can have for ourselves? You know, when you think about, you know, cyclic existence being as horrible as it is, isn't the most loving thing we can do for ourselves wanting ourselves to get out of it and be free of it? Yeah? And so when we see renunciation, what, you know, like that, then we see renunciation does not mean, you know, oh, I can't have anything I want because I'm so renounced, you know. But renunciation is really the essence of kindness towards ourselves. Isn't it? You know, I really want myself to be happy. I don't want to keep getting born again and again and again because cyclic existence stinks, you know. I want something better for myself. And so, you know, when we see that kindness means cultivating the various Dharma attitudes, yeah, then it becomes so much easier to think in a constructive way and, you know, to indulge ourselves with loving kindness towards ourselves and others. Okay? And I think it's also important to remember that part of joyous effort means knowing when to rest. Okay? Shanti Devi even said it. It's in Bodhicharyavatara. He said it. Yeah, it's one of my favorite passages besides chapter 6. You know, that knowing how to rest and resting our mind. Okay, what does resting our mind mean? You know, resting our mind doesn't mean filling it with all these violent movies. Yeah, resting our mind can be just learning to sit quietly and enjoy breathing. You know, you don't even have to sit in perfect meditation position to do it. Just lean back on the sofa and enjoy being who you are. You know, appreciate the moment. Yeah. So I think there's many ways to be kind to ourselves. I think, you know, accepting ourselves as being kind to ourselves. What I am is good enough. What I'm doing is good enough. What I have is good enough. That's a very good thing. So I mean, when you think about it deeply in this way, the kind of qualities we're trying to cultivate in the Dharma are really the essence of kindness for ourselves. Yeah? And like His Holiness says, if you want to cherish yourself, then cherish others. So it's kind of like if you want to be kind to yourself, the best way to do it is to be able to cherish others. And, you know, to bring that mind of cherishing others instead of, you know, sometimes we're so tense meditating on cherishing others. You know, I don't know about you, but it's like, my selfishness is so bad. I get reborn in the hell realm so much because I'm so selfish. I hate myself because I'm so selfish. There's so many disadvantages of self-cherishing thought, and I am the epitome of them. So I cherish others. I cherish all these other people. I'm going to make myself cherish them, even though they don't appreciate me. I'm going to cherish them because they're the thing that all my enlightenment depends on. So I love them. I'm so exhausted from this meditation on love. You know? trying too hard, you know? We're being neurotic about trying to love sentient beings. Yeah? And it's I think Dharma practice has to be approached with some kind of just gentleness and some kind of, you know, tenderness instead of forcing ourselves. I'm going to make myself love George Bush. Yeah, I've got to have compassion for all sentient beings. So I've got to make myself have compassion for George Bush. How in the world am I going to do this? So, you know, instead of forcing ourselves, just being a little bit gentle, you know. I mean, look at George. And would you want to grow up in his family? Think about it. Would you want to be the son or daughter of George Bush Sr.? Would you want to grow up in that family? No wonder he turned out the way he did, you know. I mean, would you want to grow up as a child of a Texas oil millionaire, you know, with who knows what going on? You know? Then, when you think about that, then it's possible to have compassion for this guy, because look at the kind of condition he had, and look at the kind of pressure he had as a kid. You know, I mean, going to Yale and being a C student, boy, you know, from a family like that, that ain't gonna do. So, you know, when you think about really what happened in his life, then it becomes possible. So instead of forcing ourselves to have compassion, just kind of stepping back and looking at, you know, what somebody's life is about and letting the compassion come. Okay? Yeah.
I was going to say, after all, he was once our mother.
Yeah, he's been our mom. Yep. Yeah, I keep remembering, you know, how they say how Atisha used to go out, and even when he'd see a donkey, he would say, "Hello, Mom." You know, I think that's a very good practice. I do that sometimes when I see animals or different beings, just to, you know, in your mind, say, "Hello, Mom." And it's like, oh, yeah, we're connected. Yeah?
Another thing that seems to be pervasive in our culture is the need for immediacy. You know, just on part of all of this information, you know, so we want things to happen immediately. And this endeavor of bringing ourselves to others from samsara and achieving the very mind-boggling task. So there's this juxtaposition of wanting immediately and then also knowing that it's something that is huge benefit. How do you phrase
it? How do we work with that? Okay. So the question is that they talk about attaining enlightenment now, and also our culture, we want instant gratification, don't we? We're busy people. Yeah, I've got to attain enlightenment quickly because I have a lot of things to do, you know. And so there's that, you know, this need for immediacy. And yet, we're also told that it's going to take, you know, how many lifetimes. So how do you put these things together and how do we live like that? You know? So they say to aspire to attain enlightenment in this life, but don't expect to. Okay, so to cultivate that motivation, but again, not expect it. And I think another of our biggest difficulties in the West is this thing of expecting instant fulfillment and instant gratification, push button enlightenment. Yeah, and especially coming from a consumer society where we're used to, you know, paying our money and getting the goods. It's like, you know, I've come to Dharma class, I've given my donation, where's my enlightenment? Yeah, you told me it's possible to get enlightened in this very lifetime, and I've been meditating a whole month now. Yeah, where's my enlightenment? And we can get very frustrated. And His Holiness actually comments a lot about this, saying that this is a big problem for us, is that we don't have this long-term vision to stick to it with. And I think what, you know, so there's our culture, that, you know, how we're conditioned by our culture of, you know, I've got to progress and I've got to attain it and I've got to get it, you know. So there's that kind of tension and pressure that we put on ourselves. And there's also certain scriptural passages where you hear, you know, we should practice dharma like our hair's on fire. Have you heard that one? You know, we should practice dharma like our hair's on fire. So what do we think? My hair's on fire. What do? I am panicked and freaked out, and I run all over trying to do everything I possibly can to get the fire out of my hair. Okay? So look at what our association is. It's being panicky. It's being, uncentered by running all around trying to do too much to get this fire in our hair out. That is the meaning we get out of that story. I don't think that's the meaning that the masters intended. Okay? Because clearly if you're totally freaked out about your hair being on fire, you're going to have a very difficult time putting it out, because your panic and your freaked outedness is a big obstacle. You know? So I think what those kinds of things mean is that you go about something systematically. Oh, my hair's on fire. I have a problem here. Okay, what do I need to do to oppose this water? I need some... to oppose this fire, I need some water. Where am I going to get the water? Over here. How am I going to get there? I'm going to go as quick as I can, but I'm not going to run because it could be slippery and I may fall on the way. Okay? So sometimes we misinterpret these things that are said in the scriptures, and we use them to reinforce our, you know, our neurotic tendency to push ourselves and to put ourselves down for not achieving what we think we should have achieved by now. Okay? And so I think to be able to step back and think, really, you know, what the purpose is I'm going to full enlightenment. It's all going to be a long way out there, but I'm going there, and you get there by taking one step after the next. Yeah, you don't get there by springboarding to enlightenment. You get there by one step after the next. So I've got to take one step after the next, and that's what I'm doing, and I'm doing it in a nice, relaxed way, because if I do it with a relaxed mind, I'm actually going to get there quicker than if I do it with a panicked mind. Because when I'm panicked, I waste all my energy and my time, and I don't get anything done. When I'm, you know, kind of centered, then I can just focus on doing what needs to be done in the very next step, the very next moment. Okay? And I think that having that long-term motivation of bodhicitta is so important with our lives, you know, because it's just, for me anyway, bodhicitta was the thing that it just gave so much meaning and purpose to my life. Because it's like, what else are you going to do? Yeah? It's like, what else are you going to do? You know, we've been selfish enough. We've gotten our own way enough. We've, you know, been there, done that. We have so many t-shirts. What else are we going to do? We need to do something different this life. So bodhicitta is doing something different. So it's going to take a long time, but hey, what else am I going to do? It's the only worthwhile thing doing. Nothing else is really worthwhile. So I'm doing that. It's going to take a long time. That's okay. I'm so glad I'm on that path. Yeah.
Yes. I have a follow up on that.
Uh-huh.
Well, in the West, I attended because of my mind so screwed up and so many things. I attended a therapy with a psychologist, and psychologists have this thing that if you do such and such, you should always give yourself a reward system. That's what the psychologists teach in the West. Give yourself a little something because you did such and such. And with that question, he was asking also, was, breaking the cycle up, you know, it's not a word that's come up in me. I hear you say Buddhism is.
I think what we want, your thing is about how we, you know, some psychologists teach us to reward ourselves when we do something well. I think what we're trying to do in our practice is that the practice itself becomes the reward. Yeah. It's like, oh, I was able to be generous. I feel good. Yeah. I was able to restrain myself from not telling somebody off. I feel good about myself. Yeah. And so that the actual practice, I mean, when our mind is in a wholesome, virtuous state, it's a happy mind, isn't it? That's what we got to get through our thick skull, you know, that positive attitudes actually feel good and positive emotions actually feel good. And so then generating them becomes the reward ourselves. And I think when we're talking about joyous effort, it's the mind that takes delight in virtue. Okay? So that mind, that practice itself becomes the happiness. Yeah.
I just wanted to, what was coming up in my mind too, as we're talking about these things of, you know, staying connected, or, you know, whether or not we're making progress. I think I often, you know, say to myself, what does that have to do with taking refuge as we work along the path, or as we start on the path? That taking refuge in the teacher, the teaching, in the group that we're with also gives us some kind of support and connection.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we may not be seeing so many big results on a day-to-day or month-to-month or year-to-year basis, it's this sort of connection that we have.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, you know, is that something that you are aware of doing as you go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that I'm not so much expecting the results, you know, as far as what I see externally, but that there's a refuge there.
Yeah, okay. So you're talking about refuge and not expecting external results, whatever they are, but a feeling of connection growing in your heart. And could that be some indication of progressing on the path? And I think definitely yes. You know, I think, you know, what you were saying about being connected to the teacher and the teachings and the group, you know, I think that the more that we've taken Dharma into our hearts and the more we've transformed our own hearts, that is the meaning of having a deeper connection with our teachers. You know, that being connected with our teacher doesn't necessarily mean flitting around them, serving them tea, knowing what's going on in their lives. But it means developing the same motivation as they do. And then we feel really connected. Or, you know, when you're living your life and you need help and you do a 911 to Geshe-la, you know, like, I'm freaking out now, I can't stand this person, Geshe-la, what do I do? And then you hear, you know, chapter 6 coming in your ear. Yeah, because you've heard it from him so much. You know, and so your feeling of connectedness with Geshe-la comes very strongly at that time, because it's the Dharma that's connecting you. You know? And the teachings in your own heart, not just the hearing of the teachings, but the extent to which you rely on the teachings, of course you feel more connected with your teacher as you practice. And, you know, the Dharma refuge is what they say is the real refuge, you know, the Dharma that we cultivate in here. So even, you know, forget realization of emptiness or bodhicitta, just learning, you know, not to get so angry. That's an incredible practice of the Dharma, and it's deepening our refuge in the Dharma teachings. That is the Dharma. Our practice of patience that we've actualized in here is the Dharma. you know. And so, of course, feeling closer to our teacher and the Buddha and the Sangha as a result, because they're the ones who support us in generating the Dharma in our hearts. And then the connectedness to the group as well, I think, is very important, you know, and to really cherish each other, like I was saying before, because we all have this spiritual appreciation and these spiritual qualities inside, and appreciating each other for that and feeling connected. You know, here's a group of people that, you know, if I'm having problems, I can go and talk to a Dharma friend, and instead of siding with me against somebody else and, you know, encouraging me to be more jealous or more spiteful, my Dharma friend is going to, you know, remind me of how to transform my mind. And, you know, feeling connected with our Dharma friends because they help us. And then just feeling connected with a group of people who have that aspiration to create virtue. I mean, we've been in so many groups in our whole life. You know, you go to the movie theater, you're with a group of people. You go to the football game, you're with a group of people. You go to the university, you're with a group of people. How many groups of people are we ever with where everybody comes there with the bodhicitta motivation? I mean, it's a special group. So, you know, to value the connection with the group and value the individuals in it. And I think that just seeing that those connections grow deeper in our own heart, that's indicative of our refuge getting deeper, because we could be out taking refuge in, you know, the refrigerator and the shopping center and the car and the credit card and the television, and we're not taking refuge in this. Does that answer your question? Is that what you were getting at? Okay, let's just sit for about 5 minutes and do a little closing meditation before we dedicate. So maybe think a little bit about what we were talking about.